my friend and your co-patriot, Dr. Revelo P. Oliver.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am very happy to be here tonight. I deeply appreciate that extravagant introduction my good friend Ed Schwille gave me. I only wish that I could begin to live up to it in some small way. Ladies and gentlemen, I was told that a few months ago there was a convention of state psychiatrists. They gathered for their convention and they all began to complain about their crushing caseload. For although each of them had a large staff, there were so many complicated tests of a patient's sanity that it was taking many man hours per case. One man had it down to 50, another had it 70, and one had it 100 man hours. They all complained and complained, except one man who sat there smiling. He finally said that he had no staff. He was alone at his institution. He didn't feel overburdened. "You see," he said, "I have a small waiting room with a concrete floor. All that's in it, a few chairs, big stack of mops in the corner, and a water tap sticking out of one wall. I ask the patients to wait for me in there, and as I leave, I turn on the water. Well, the nuts grab the mops and go to work, and the sane ones just turn off the tap." Well, you people in Dallas have decided to turn off the tap. I'm proud and happy to be in the city. In which American citizens first gathered together spontaneously to express their indignation over the manifest betrayal of the United States by powerful and secret elements within our society and within our federal government. As you know, what you began here on the 14th of October has spread over the nation. When I last heard a few days ago, your example had been followed by 155 cities in 45 states. And this movement has only begun. I think it not unlikely that if the United States survives, Dallas will have for historians of the future a significance comparable to that of Lexington today. But just as Lexington marks the beginning of the struggle that freed the American colonies from the open dominion of a foreign power, so will Dallas in the future mark the beginning of a struggle to liberate the United States from the covert dominion of a power that is not only foreign, but actually unhuman. For many, many years, the American people as a whole have shown a massive, a monumental, an almost incredible indifference to what was happening to them. The evidence was there, but no one seemed to heed it. To be sure, every month since 1945, conceivably every week, there was held someplace in this vast country of ours a meeting of patriots who clearly stated the dangers confronting our nation. But these were generally meetings of small groups of individuals, often regarded as eccentrics in their own communities, and so few that even when they met together, They seemed a small band, lonely and forlorn, lost in a desert of complacency. They were generally ignored by our news services, or whenever a group became too large to be successfully ignored, it was promptly puked upon by the professional character assassins whom the communist conspiracy had long before planted in our communication system. We owe a great deal, ladies and gentlemen, to the few who continued through all those long and dreary years a struggle that often seemed hopeless. Since I have said that, I must add that I do not have the honor to be numbered among those whom I have praised. I am a latecomer to anti-communist activity. When I left Washington near the end of 1945, I was able to make some estimate of the depth and extent of communist penetration of most segments of our government, but I was also firmly convinced that exposure of them was inevitable, and I was absolutely certain that within a few years, between 1949 and 1952, according to my best calculations, a great wave of indignation would sweep over this nation, and that there would take place in Washington and in many another spot such a house cleaning as had not perhaps been seen on earth since the flood. It was with the utmost complacency, therefore, that I completely immured myself in the branch of scholarship that affords me the keenest of all pleasures, and there I remained for years in happy oblivion. I felt my first sense of alarm when the communist conspiracy, obviously by an all-out effort, succeeded in silencing the late Senator Joseph McCarthy. And even then it took me some time to understand that the first duty of an American citizen is not to wait for somebody else to do his duty for him, because he has something else that he would rather do. I am a latecomer, and I speak with full awareness of that. I now firmly believe, ladies and gentlemen, that at long, long last, we Americans as a people have become indignant and intend to stay that way. That we have reached the point at which we will no longer submit to lies and intimidation from bizarre little men in seats of power who seem to have forgotten that they were elected or appointed to represent us. That they are our employees, hired to work for us, not for our enemies. We are angry and we intend to stay that way until we have made America unsafe for traitors. Because, ladies and gentlemen, the word is out. It has been uttered and the issues are at last clear. We have passed the point at which we could be distracted and confused with endless quibbling as to whether Mr. X is a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy, or just a muddled egghead, ostrich-sized, with a brain so big that one lobe of it doesn't know what the other is doing. We need no longer listen to assurances that Mr. Y is a well-meaning little fellow who should be allowed to go on ruining the United States because he's just chock full of ideals and is playing with our lives as innocently as he used to play with teddy bears. All of that is utterly irrelevant. I know of no statement of the one single vital issue that is clearer than that made here in Dallas by Major Knickerbocker, whose patriotism and courage initiated this great movement. I know that you have heard it. Let me quote it again. Quote, Benedict Arnold was sincere in his belief, but he will be remembered forever, I hope, as the symbol of American treason. Modern traitors, whoever they may be, however high their offices, however sincere they may be, are still traitors. No amount of sincerity can change that. Their acts must not be excused, and they must not go unpunished. It was that with that understanding that we have met here tonight, and it was that understanding, ladies and gentlemen, that we must go forward, unperturbed by the hysterical screeching of politicians, whatever may be their motive, and greatly encouraged by the frenzied spitting of pseudo-intellectual criminals and nincompoops. If it be extremism to be loyal to one's country, then we are extremists. Fanaticism to want to preserve our own lives and the lives of our children, then we are fanatics, and that is that. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I am sure that other speakers have outlined for you the structure and methods of the international communist conspiracy and the appalling history of its conquest of more than two-thirds of the world in the 43 years that have elapsed since it first attained power in Russia. I am sure that you also know that all of those conquests have been affected by internal subversion and by covert manipulation of the governments of non-communist countries, especially that of the United States. You also know, ladies and gentlemen, that the conspiracy has been deeply and continuously entrenched in our federal government for more than 20 years. That, for example, the acts of treason whose disclosure first roused your indignation, the training of communist pilots in our latest techniques at your expense, and the equipment of a communist army with our latest and best weapons at your expense, forms part of a consistent policy that has been pursued under the flimsiest of pretexts since 1945, when the United States, in conjunction with Great Britain, shamefully betrayed its ally, General Mihailovich, and betrayed the legitimate government of Yugoslavia to turn that country over to a known communist criminal, an admitted agent of the Kremlin, who was operating under the alias of Tito. You also know that while the one act of handing Yugoslavia over to the communist conspiracy might be explained as some stupid blunder made in the haste and confusion of war, its cause cannot be mistaken when we see that it was part of a consistent pattern, corresponding exactly to what was done in the name of the United States at about the same time: the betrayal of Poland, the surrender of East Germany and its part, the partition of all Germany, and the delivery of Czechoslovakia, with the full knowledge that we were, by forcing our own armies to retreat from the areas that they had already taken, we were delivering to the Soviet the uranium mines, which are now the Soviet's principal source of atomic materials. It corresponded exactly to what was done then or a little later in other parts of the world, notably China. It is substantially the same pattern that was recently used in Cuba, where, as everyone now knows, the communist conquest of that base so near to our shores was made possible only by the active cooperation of our State Department and possibly of other agencies of our government. The only change since 1945 is that treason has now become so bold and so flushed with constant success that it no longer takes the trouble to devise more than the most perfunctory and transparent pretext for its operations. In all this time, the communist conspiracy has, I think, made just one mistake. It has come to believe that the patience and apathy of the American people are indeed infinite. The whole gang of international criminals has obviously come to share the opinion of their titular head, Khrushchev, whose contempt for our stupidity is so great that he publicly proclaimed in Moscow, "When you spit in the faces of Americans, they think it's due." I think that Khrushchev and his faithful servants in the United States are mistaken, badly mistaken. Up in Illinois, they still tell stories of an early evangelist. It was there in frontier days, a man named Cartwright, a big, powerful man, and also a man of unrivaled placidity and patience. They say that he once went into a frontier saloon and tried to talk to the men assembled there. One particular heckler began to jeer at him at first in asides and then in loud interruptions. All this Cartwright bore with unruffled patience. And finally, the heckler, growing bold, stepped up and said to Cartwright, "Say, do you believe that stuff in the Bible about turning the other cheek?" "I do," said Cartwright. Whereupon the man hit off and hit him a blow on the cheek. Cartwright merely meekly turned the other cheek. This time, the heckler delivered a blow that shook even the evangelist's great frame. "Now what you going to do?" sneered the man. "Turn the other cheek again?" "Why," said Cartwright in his mild voice, slipping off his coat, "the Bible says to turn the other cheek, and I have done that. But it doesn't say what to do afterwards. So now I am going to beat hell out of you." Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, let me call your attention to three areas of immediate danger in which we simply must take action now. The first and most obvious is our Air Force, which is being brazenly liquidated before our very eyes. In Washington last April, I heard General Bonner-Fellers analyze the situation at that time. He pointed out, first, that rockets and ballistic missiles, however highly developed, are not and cannot be a substitute for manned airplanes. And that is a statement that I believe no one has officially challenged. Our power to retaliate in the event of a Russian attack depends primarily, therefore, on the squadrons of B-52s that are now in service. The general pointed out last April that our B-52s were rapidly wearing out and were not being replaced, while the production of superior aircraft had been repeatedly frustrated by our government on the pretext that economy was necessary so that funds could be diverted to foreign aid. A distinguished military expert, when queried at the time concerning the reasons for such a policy, replied in these carefully chosen terms: "This policy is intelligible only on the assumption that by 1965 the United States will have ceased to exist as an independent nation." Here is the present situation as summarized by General Fellers last month. Washington has officially announced that no more B-52s will be built and that the production of the B-58 has been halted. And what is more, the entire program for building the B-70, a highly superior bomber, which is 9 times as effective as the B-52, and against which Russia could not construct an adequate defense without placing on her economic system a burden that it almost certainly could not stand, that program has been completely scrapped. The experimental development of even superior craft has been virtually halted. Instead, we have announced, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, that we are going to build 585 of the long obsolete subsonic airplanes that can carry only the old-fashioned explosive bombs. And those museum pieces are virtually the only aircraft that we are going to build. What is even more significant, The defense budget now drawn up cuts the production of the Minuteman missiles to 1/6. And it cuts in half the appropriation for research and development. As a result, as General Fellers puts it, in 1965, for the first time, we shall lag behind Soviet Russia in technology because we are planning it that way. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the gang in Washington is openly planning to make the United States helpless before Soviet Russia. And it is doing that with a brazenness that is almost unbelievable. You will remember that the Congress, which recently adjourned, appropriated for the Air Force $780,300,000 more than the administration had requested, appropriated it for the express purpose of maintaining at least our strength in B-52s. And you may have noticed that on the 27th of October, Mr. McNamara, the socialist professor from Harvard, who for some mysterious reason is now our Secretary of Defense, publicly announced that he was overruling the Congress of the United States because he had decided that the American people did not need any more air power. The sheer insolence of that gesture is matched only by the insolence with which the same little white recently refused to answer questions from the Armed Services Committee on the grounds that not even the Senate had a right to know what his underlings were doing to undermine the morale of our armed services and to deceive the American people. Can there be more than one explanation for such a policy? Now, ladies and gentlemen, let us glance for a few minutes at an extremely vital area of our national defense, one that you seldom see mentioned, our intelligence agencies. They are a delicate subject with which to deal because a very large part of their work has to be cloaked in the strictest secrecy. But let me assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that no activity is more vital to the survival of our nation. How important it is, you may judge from the fact that it can reasonably be argued. Not a certainty, of course, but it can reasonably be argued, for reasons that I have tried to outline in the November issue of American Opinion, it can be argued that the real reason why Germany lost the last war was the presence of just one traitor, Admiral Canaris, who was chief of her intelligence service. You can make a case for it, a reasonable case. And that is a pretty good measure of the importance of intelligence service. Until 1945, our intelligence work was divided between a number of agencies which maintained only a loose liaison with one another. By a process of reorganization and consolidation, virtually all of these have been compressed into just two mammoth organizations, the National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency. Over the years, there have been a number of indications that all was not well in the National Security Agency, but they were of a kind that could have been interpreted only by an observer who was looking for specific evidence. Public attention was first drawn to that agency last year when two perverts and traitors in it, a person named Mitchell, who had been trained at Stanford and the California Institute of Technology, and a person named Martin, who had been trained at the Washington College of Education and the University of Illinois. When these people fled secretly from the United States to their real employer in Moscow, and there began a series of radio and television broadcasts which made it impossible for American authorities to cover up the scandal any longer. Now it is interesting that the previous records of Mitchell and Martin were such as to make it obvious to anyone with the slightest experience in intelligence work that they should never have been admitted within the doors of an intelligence agency in the first place. But what was far more interesting was a discovery accidentally made in the course of a preliminary congressional inquiry into the circumstances. An officer of the National Security Agency, a person of mixed Russian origin named Maurice Klein, appeared before the committee and had to admit that he had obtained employment in the agency by falsifying his own record, misrepresenting his parentage, his academic record, and other details, and neglecting to mention that he had from time to time changed his name. All these mistakes, he said, were the result of mere forgetfulness. Well, that may be possible, although I confess that I have a great difficulty in imagining the kind of mind that can forget, for example, that it did not spend 3 years in a given law school. And then, even if a man can be that absent-minded, could he also forget what he had been really doing during all of those years in which he was not attending the college that he has forgotten that he didn't go to? Well, let that go. The important thing is this. The falsifications on Mr. Klein's record were of a kind that the clumsiest private detective in Dallas could not have failed to spot in the course of even a cursory investigation, such as many private employers have made as a matter of routine whenever they employ anyone in a fiduciary capacity. Klein was not a mere payroll clerk. He was in one of the two most highly secret agencies of this nation, one in which a mere clerk, if disloyal, could inflict on us damage comparable to a tactical defeat in the course of an actual battle. And in that vital agency, Klein was not a mere clerk. He was, and until a few days ago he remained, in charge of employment in the whole National Security Agency. And that means that this master of absent-mindedness passed on the loyalty and other qualifications of everyone entering that agency and decided to whom the safety of the United States should be entrusted. It was a position in which he had the power, if he so desired, or if he suffered another attack of absent-mindedness, the power to introduce hundreds of communist agents into a very vital area of our national defense. Mitchell and Martin were two of the 1,000 persons whom he did introduce into the National Security Agency. And we can only wonder whether they had comrades who haven't yet disclosed themselves by running home to Mother Russia. Now, I shall not ask the obvious question whether it is conceivable that no American born of American parents and nurtured in the American tradition, was available to serve in so strategic a position in our National Security Agency. Nor shall I comment on the extremely odd circumstance that Mr. Klein seems to have zoomed into that position without the slightest experience in any one of the several kinds of intelligence work that is done by the National Security Agency, and with no known talents fitting him for that work, other, of course, than a positive genius for forgetting things. And we need not try to speculate on what may be disclosed if this man is tried, as the House Committee has demanded, for perjury and for tampering with official files. The important point is that the admitted falsifications could have been easily detected and were furthermore a prima facie ground for deep suspicion. There were therefore only three possible explanations of Klein's presence in the National Security Agency. Either A, his record was never checked, or B, it was checked, but the findings were falsified by someone before the report reached the chief of the National Security Agency at that time. Or C, the report was made accurately to that chief and was ignored by him. Now, one of those explanations must be the right one. and even the mildest of the three, is conclusive proof of criminal negligence of the kind that no nation can tolerate and long survive. At the very least, then, the situation in the National Security Agency is profoundly disquieting. When we turn to the Central Intelligence Agency, we find cause for alarm in almost every fact that has come to light about it. And the facts are so many that one hardly knows where to begin. As you know, the Central Intelligence Agency is an organization so secret that not even the chairman of committees in our House and Senate are permitted to know how much of your money they appropriate for it each year. The appropriations, which according to some estimates I have heard, total $1 billion, are concealed in other items in other budgets and then siphoned off by some kind of trick bookkeeping. The agency has, one hears, grown greatly and changed drastically. Since 1949, when the man who was head of it at that time, Admiral Hillenketter, was removed from office because he had dared to answer an official inquiry from Senator McCarran concerning 100 new appointees to the so-called United Nations. Of those 100, 29 were known to be officers in the Communist Party, and 32 were known to be members of the Russian espionage system. But Admiral Hillenketter was removed as head of the agency as punishment for having revealed those facts to the head of a committee of the United States Senate. All that we know of the present structure of the agency is that it maintains a staff of from 12,000 to 17,000 faceless agents, some of whom at least are recent recruits from Central or Eastern Europe of extremely dubious antecedents, some of whom have long communist records, and none of whom is subject to a security check by the FBI, the Army, or any other independent agency. It is indeed curious that the CIA has used for operations within the United States, mind you, some agents who have not learned to speak coherent English. And it is even more curious the operations of the CIA that have thus far come to light were operations whose net results promoted the international communist conspiracy. Since our time is so limited, let us notice a few aspects of the CIA's part in establishing the Soviet base in Cuba. You will remember that Mr. Earl E.T. Smith, who was our ambassador to Cuba at the time that the communists took over that island, testified before the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security that, quote, "Without the United States, Castro would not be in power today." Our State Department's role in that betrayal of our country is now generally known, at least in part. But we must not forget that the CIA was also involved. Among the people in the American Embassy in Havana who were partisans of Castro, Mr. Smith listed the head of the Central Intelligence Agency's Cuban division. Now notice, ladies and gentlemen, that that automatically means that the chief of our intelligence service in Cuba was at least pro-communist, because conclusive proof that that noisome degenerate, Fidel Castro, was a communist agent was available in the files of any large newspaper, and I think we could reasonably expect so expensive an intelligence agency to know as much or perhaps even a little more than the newspapers. But that is not all. The assistant head of the Cuban office of our Central Intelligence Agency was caught by the Cuban government in an attempt to incite or encourage mutiny in the Cuban Navy for the benefit of Fidel Castro and the communist conspiracy in September 1957. This man, when confronted with proof, confessed to Ambassador Smith that he had met a group of conspirators and that he had taken it on himself to promise them the approval and support of the United States of America should Castro's revolt succeed. But in an attempt to palliate that incredible act, he went on to say that he had not known that the conspirators to whom he talked were officers in the Cuban Navy, because he, as an experienced military intelligence agent, was unable to tell the difference between naval officers and dentists, because both wear white coats in the tropics. According to the sworn testimony of the president-elect of Cuba, even more drastic interventions on behalf of the communist conspiracy were subsequently made by American agents, presumably from the CIA. And there is another interesting point. As you know, Castro received some of his supplies from Russian submarines. He received more from Romulo Betancourt, the Kremlin's viceroy in Venezuela, whom you taxpayers finance there. But he also received large quantities directly from the United States, supposedly through the activity of smugglers whom American authorities seem never able to apprehend. The gossip in Washington now is that that smuggling was organized and financed by our Central Intelligence Agency. That is rumor, but it is rumor that merits the most serious investigation. Now let us skip over the intervening years to 1961 and consider for a moment the obviously phony invasion of Cuba. As is now openly admitted, that operation was planned, organized, financed, and at every stage directed by our Central Intelligence Agency. And it is now obvious to everyone that the net results of that operation were three. First, to consolidate the theretofore shaky communist regime in Cuba. Second, to humiliate the United States and make us ridiculous in the eyes of the rest of the world. And third, thereby greatly to strengthen the communist conspiracy throughout the world, and especially in Latin America, which it is now in the process of taking over country by country. Now let us see how our Central Intelligence Agency carried out this operation. It began by organizing a Democratic Revolutionary Front that was headed by some odd Cubans who were conveniently in the United States for the occasion. To wit, Dr. Jose Miró Cardona, who had been Fidel Castro's first prime minister, and Manuel Rey Rivero, who had been the leader of Castro's underground in Havana for 13 months before the communist victory, and then became Castro's minister of public works. Hovering in the background was Aureliano Sanchez Arango, who was one of the founders of the official Communist Party in Cuba, and his close associate, Dr. Antonio Varona. This was indeed an extraordinary crew to put in charge of what was supposedly an attempt to overthrow the communist regime in Cuba. And what made it more extraordinary was the fact that almost a year before the so-called invasion was carried out, the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security had on record sworn testimony that Sanchez Arango and Barona were working in the communist headquarters in Miami Beach, Florida, to set up an organization of reliable communists who would claim that they had broken with Fidel Castro and thus be available for use by the communist conspiracy whenever occasion might arise. Be available for use, for example, if the American people finally demanded action and it was necessary to replace Castro with a comparatively unknown person so that the New York Times and similar sheets could go on yelling for another 2 years that these were agrarian reformers and not communists. Well, the operation is carried out for the CIA had three phases. First, agents from that agency arrested and illegally detained anti-communist Cuban leaders in this country, notably Major Díaz Lanz, and immobilized others by inducing them to sit in fuel-less airplanes, supposedly in readiness for an expedition to Cuba that was not attempted. Second, a small force of men, all of whom probably were selected anti-communists. Small force of men was landed without air cover or naval support on an exposed beach where Castro's Russian, Chinese, and native troops were awaiting them and disposed of them without difficulty. Third, what was far more important, the large anti-communist underground in Cuba had been induced to mobilize itself for cooperation with the invasion and to be in readiness awaiting a signal that was never broadcast from the CIA's radio propaganda station on Swan Island. Instead, Castro's troops swooped down on many, if not all, of the sections of this underground. More than 250,000 arrests are said to have been made. And the leaders were liquidated in a long series of mass murders. It is clear that the communists possessed detailed information concerning the identity of members of the underground and the places of their meeting. How many of the active anti-communists in Cuba survived this operation is not known. If any did, they will certainly never again trust the United States. This incredible operation made it possible for ranking officials of the American government to yammer in public that the United States had received a bloody nose, and then ostentatiously to proclaim that we intended to do nothing about it. The attention of the American people was promptly distracted from Cuba by a well-timed crisis in Laos, and then by loud talk and pusillanimous action in Berlin. It seems likely, if we may judge from the ripples in that ocean of silence in Washington on the subject of Cuba, that the American people are expected to accustom themselves to having a communist bastion, complete with submarine pens, air bases, and rocket launching pads, 90 miles from their shores. It is known that military equipment from other parts of the communist empire is being poured into Cuba daily, and the only question seems to be when the architects of disaster will think the time ripe for informing us that Cuba has become impregnable, that war is unthinkable, and that we must show world opinion that we have peaceful intentions by negotiating with the Soviet for the surrender of the Virgin Islands, the Canal Zone, or perhaps a good slice of Florida. But now let us return to the CIA and notice two very interesting personalities. According to the press, the Cuban fiasco was directed by the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, a man named Richard Bissell. And who is Mr. Bissell? A fighting man? No. An experienced intelligence agent? No. His qualifications for the job seem to be that he was for a long time a professor of Keynesian economics in Yale University. His friends assure us that he is just an egghead theorist who just didn't know what he was doing in Cuba. Aside from that, there seems to be little information available about Mr. Bissell. But I find it impossible to understand why cracked eggheads have some sacred right to direct our intelligence agencies. And when I hear that this particular egg was filled with Keynesian economics, I remember with alarm the conclusions of the Veritas's carefully documented report, Keynes at Harvard, which says quite bluntly, quote, "Keynesism is not an economic theory. It is a weapon of political conspiracy." But there is even a more disturbing connection. I referred a moment ago to the CIA's radio station on Swan Island. It is now openly admitted that this station, which not only failed to give the signal to the Cuban underground, but had for a long time subtly helped the communist rulers of Cuba by broadcasting absurd rumors and occasionally putting the finger on anti-communists in Cuba, by mistake, of course. It's admitted now that the station is operated by the CIA. It is really absurd ever to pretend otherwise, because it stands on land owned by the federal government, was in fact built by the federal government. But for a long time, the CIA kept up the pretense that the station was owned and operated for commercial purposes by a mysterious private corporation. The private individual who appeared in public as a representative of this supposed corporation was a man named Jean Bernald. Since it is now conceded that Radio Swan is a CIA operation, it appears that Bernald was the CIA's front man, and that he probably is a secret representative of the CIA. This becomes very interesting when we learn that Jean Bernald is also a director of another mysterious corporation called International Media Company. This elusive company publishes a number of periodicals throughout the world, including a periodical called Drum, which is printed simultaneously in four cities in Africa, where it does a great deal to cover up for the communists and to incite hatred of white men. It may be significant, therefore, that International Media Company also publishes a dirty little smut and smear sheet, officially called the Overseas Weekly. This filthy little rag, edited by a female who calls herself Marion Rossbach, or Marion von Rossbach, with the assistance of a corps of spot and smear artists of strange or unknown antecedents, serves on the one hand to undermine both the morale and the morals of American soldiers stationed in Europe, and on the other hand to represent those American soldiers to the people of Europe as a profligate and sadistic gang whose favorite recreation is rape. You should examine for yourself a few copies of this filthy and vicious little sheet, wearing gloves while you handle it. It was officially banned from all army posts in Europe in 1953, but the ban was later revoked under pressure from a then member of Congress, Sam Yorty, who had been identified in sworn testimony as a member and agent of the Communist Party. Now, it is this nauseating slime sheet which launched the infamous attack on General Walker that marked the opening of the current drive to destroy the loyalty and morale of the American Army, a drive that can have no conceivable purpose other than to prepare the way for an eventual communist takeover of the United States. There can be no other conceivable, intelligible purpose. Now, in view of the strange link provided by the individual known as Jean Bernald, and in view of the CIA's penchant for operating mysterious corporations, we are entitled to wonder whether or not the company that publishes the Oversexed Weekly may not possibly have some intimate connection with the CIA. And if we should find that it has, we should have more reason than ever for asking the terrible question, to what extent is some part or parts of the supposedly American Central Intelligence Agency an instrumentality of the international communist conspiracy? In the few minutes remaining to us tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we cannot consider the unspeakably vile and incredibly brazen attack on General Walker and the whole campaign of which that attack marked the beginning. For one thing, I am sure you are informed about it, and I take it that no one can reasonably doubt that that campaign is simply one part of the general campaign to stamp out resistance to the communist conspiracy in the United States, a campaign launched on orders promulgated in Moscow on the 5th of last December, of which you will find a concise analysis in the hearings of the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security, published under the title, The New Drive Against the Anti-Communist Program, and available from the government printing office for 25 cents. The drive, however, does force us to face another terrible question, one that it is extremely painful to ask. To what extent have traitors entrenched themselves in the Department of Defense? We have not, so far as I know, enough information to measure the extent of that penetration, but I am afraid that it is frighteningly deep. Even back in 1945, there were some very disquieting indications which suggested the presence of communist agents in the Pentagon among the many civilians in the many strange departments that fighting men referred to as the paper doll divisions, and in perhaps among the miracle officers who had been commissioned directly from civilian life. The situation a few years later was graphically portrayed in Colonel Victor J. Fox's The Pentagon Case, a book which everyone should read. It is ostensibly a novel, but it is no secret that the story is a chronicle of actual events, slightly transposed to another department, and with, of course, fictitious names for the actual participants. But the first clear and unmistakable warning to the American people came in 1954 when Senator Joseph McCarthy interrogated a man who had been given a direct commission as captain. Given that commission when there were clear grounds for believing him to be a communist, a man who had been promoted to the rank of major after military intelligence had positive knowledge that he was a communist and who was then on active duty in the army. This man refused, on the grounds that truthful answers would incriminate him, to state whether he was a graduate of a special communist school for leaders, and whether he was then organizing communist cells in the United States Army. After this testimony, incredible as it may seem, he was whisked to safety by being hastily given an honorable discharge, obviously to forestall the court-martial to which he would otherwise have been subject. For a full story of this appalling incident, see Lionel Locus's new book, Who Promoted Paris, recently published by the bookmailer in New York. Now, it was not this one instance, nor even the fact that the investigation made it seem very likely that there were many similar instances still undetected that was so significant. The fact that Senator McCarthy was on a trail that would inevitably lead to a rat's nest of traitors in the Pentagon was conclusively shown by the sudden and desperate effort that the international communist conspiracy then made to silence Senator McCarthy, an all-out campaign that was obviously conducted to protect a very vital base of operations. Since 1954, the traitors must have entrenched themselves ever more deeply and multiplied year after year, because that is the nature of the animal, and that is the way in which communists operate. One shudders to think what their aggregate strength may be by this time. Frankly, ladies and gentlemen, whenever I try to guess, I am simply terrified. Now, there is one recent report published in a reputable newspaper that has excellent sources of information in Washington, to which I wish to call your attention. If true, it is simply staggering in its implications. Before mentioning the report, we must notice two facts. First, even more disquieting than the actions of Mr. McNamara himself, shocking as they are, is the character of the people with whom he surrounds himself. The Assistant Secretary of Defense in charge of all personnel is a weird mannequin named Adam Yaromolinsky. He is a graduate of Harvard, where in 1943 he was editor of a frankly Marxist and pro-communist sheet called Yardling. After he emerged from the big red schoolhouse in Cambridge, he became the secretary of the notorious Fund for the Republic, whose many pro-communist and anti-American activities suggest that it might more fittingly be called the Fund for the Soviet. Among its numerous publications is a snide booklet entitled Community of Fear, which tries indirectly to suggest that the United States should abolish its armed forces in order to have lots of democracy and world peace. It seems, therefore, that a connection with Marxism, which is, of course, the name for the theory underlying communism and used by it for propaganda purposes, and approval of the destruction of our armed forces, are the ideal qualifications which make a man the inevitable choice for Assistant Secretary of Defense. All right, the second fact is this. On the 18th of last July, one of Khrushchev's most adroit agents, Lieutenant Colonel Alexandrovsky of the Russian Army, delivered a speech which was reported in the Red Star, the official newspaper of the Russian Army, and broadcast over Radio Volga in Russia. This speech consisted of a violent denunciation of General Walker and all other loyal officers in the American Army, and it differed from the puke spewed out by the Overseas Weekly, the New York Times, the Worker, and similar sheets, only in that Alexandrovsky quite frankly said that all opposition to the Soviet in the United States Army must be ruthlessly stamped out to make our army a reliable instrument of international communism. And he proceeded to outline the methods to be used in accomplishing this end. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the Putnam Sun, which is a small paper, but has, as I have said, excellent contacts in Washington, reported in its issue for the 7th of September that the speech that Lieutenant Colonel Alexandrovsky had made on the 18th of July was a speech actually delivered in the Pentagon building in Washington and relayed from there to Radio Volga by way of Berlin. It was given in the Pentagon building at the invitation and in the presence of Adam Yaromolinsky, Assistant Secretary of Defense. Now, the sheer effrontery of such an act seems incredible. I cannot vouch for the truth of that report. I came upon it only a few days ago, and I have not had time to check it through independent sources. But we live, ladies and gentlemen, in a time in which no effrontery, no audacity, no enormity is beyond belief. You spit in their faces, said Khrushchev, and they call it dues. Ladies and gentlemen, if we are at last weary of this stinking due, let us remember that, as J. Edgar Hoover has repeatedly told us, we are now at war with communism. And remember, second, that the Constitution of the United States clearly defines treason. Let us arise in righteous and implacable anger. Let us highly resolve here that the traitors shall be identified, and what is more, as Major Knickerbocker has said, they must not go unpunished. Ladies and gentlemen, I can't tell you how much you have warmed my heart and how much you have encouraged me. At last, thank God, I see the American people awakening. And ladies and gentlemen, when we awaken, we are a force that cannot be resisted. We have the power if we have only the courage to use it. And it is up to each and every one of us to have that courage. We have the power, ladies and gentlemen. We can do it. And we can see to it that they do not go unpunished.